Hi gang, Barry here. Quick one before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with our guest Angus Dunican returning to the podcast to talk about the world's worst ventriloquists. Just some of the usual odds and ends, really. If you enjoy what we do here on Worst Foot Forward, then please visit patreon.com/worstfootforward and chuck us a few quid a month or a one-off donation, whichever takes your fancy. Ben and I love doing the show and we have a huge number of recordings lined up for the next month or so. And we just love to keep making it, and that job is made much easier by the donations of those of you who join us on Patreon, who get access to all sorts of bonus interviews with our guests, videos of live shows, extra bits and pieces. And if you donate as little as $5 a month, I believe it is, or £5, then you get to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, and we're covering a few of those in our upcoming recordings. If you want to follow Ben and me, obviously you can do that via the podcast's social media outlets. That's Worst Foot on Twitter and Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook, and our website is worstfootforwardpodcast.com. And you can also email us on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you want to get in touch about anything you find, or hop into the Discord channel where people share bits and pieces of their own trivia and various channels on there. So the Discord link is in the podcast description. Finally, you can follow Ben and myself individually. Ben is on at Vanderlaugh, wherever you care to look. And I am at Baz McStay on Twitter or at Barry McStay on Instagram. And a final thank you to those of you who came and saw my play, Breeding, which just finished its run in London this month. It was nice to see a couple of Worst Foot Forward listeners there as well. Greatly appreciated supporting my non-podcast interests. But we're podcast-focused this week, and holy moly, Angus is a wonderful guest, a lovely friend of both Ben's and mine. We are so glad he came back, and what a choice world's worst ventriloquist turned out to be. You'll really enjoy this one, folks.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to Worst Foot Forward. My name is Ben van der Velde, and this week we're joined by a very special guest, Little Barry. Say hello to the boys and girls, Little Barry. Gello, boys and girls. Gello, gower goo. That's very polite of you. Guess it, giz gen. You're such a good little sidekick, aren't you? Guess guy, I'm the guest guy kicking all of godcasting girls. Now, boys and girls, Little Barry has got a special party piece that he would like to perform for you. Are you going to perform for the boys and girls, Little Barry? Guess guy gam. And what are you going to perform? Gam gung gong Shakespeare's ghost gamus gugiliki. What, Shakespeare's most famous soliloquy? Guess. And what's that? Googi gorgot gooby. From Hamlet, Gamlet. Hamlet, Gamlet. Yes? Guess. Okay. Here you go, Little Barry. 1, 2, 3. Googi gorgot googi. Gag is good question. Gag gig is again. Gogler. Little Barry, you're giggling, aren't you? Higgling? Yes, giggling. Hot? Got. Guess? Guess. That was quite a gargantuan undertaking, wasn't it? Guess. It was gargantuan. Hang on. You can't say the letter G when you say the word gargantuan. Yes. Yes? Guess. Yes? You're being very weird, Little Barry. Guess. Why are you getting moody with me? Gug up, you hunt. What? Hunt. What? Anyway, before this nascent variety duo falls to pieces in front of you, I should introduce you to the inspiration for Little Barry. He is the Keith Harris to my Orville, the Nina Conti to my monkey, and the invasive controlling hand to my fundament. It is, of course, Barry McStay.
I think that's the point at which the podcast jumped its marionette shark. There are going to be people for whom that will have been completely indecipherable.
I mean, probably. It would have helped if I could have done an Irish accent.
Yeah, yes, no, that would have helped. You're right. are there many ventriloquists gigging these days? There's not really the same sort of... The stand-up circuit isn't really the sort of the variety of acts that it used to be back maybe 40, 50
years
ago.
Are there any ventriloquist acts higging at the moment, Barry?
Yes, higging at the moment, yeah. Apart from the great Nina Conti, of course.
There's the great Negroni. There's Paul Zerdin. There is Jeff Dunham, who I assume now works the Republican right-wing circuit with his awful terrorist puppet. And there's a newer act who I can't remember, but it's sort of... You know, occasionally, when people say there are people who are born out of time, they often talk about people who are born ahead of their time. Mm. But there are some people who are born in the year 1999 but have a face from 1939. And I think there's a guy working the alternative circuit now who looks like he should be on a variety bill with Harry Secombe and Barry Cryer.
Neville Chuckles Chamberlain, they call him.
Yeah. There's not many vent acts. Although I tell you what, with each passing day, Jimmy Carr is looking more and more like a ventriloquist's dummy, isn't he?
Very, very true. Well, nevertheless, we will be talking about the world's worst ventriloquist, and we're doing so in the company of a returning guest. Our guest this week is an actor, comedian, improviser, immersive theatre performer alongside myself in the likes of The Crystal Maze and Doctor Who Time Fracture, and writer for the Doctor Who Big Finish audio collection. I will now drink this glass of squash while he continues to introduce himself. Watch how my lips never move. And go.
Hello, boys and girls. Such a nice pleasure to be here at the end of Brighton Pier with my pal Barry.
Hello, it's me. It's Angus. How's it going? Ben, in answer to your question, I think the official number of currently, because it used to be in this country about 50 years ago, there used to be 400 professional ventriloquists at any given time. And now, apparently, as of about 10 years ago, there are 15 professional ventriloquists in this full-time professional ventriloquist.
I like that suggests that there's a huge underbelly of amateur ventriloquists.
Oh, yeah, there's a seething underground. That's the thing no one talks about with ventriloquism.
And then it also suggests that we need to... Well, either we just need to keep going until they're stamped out, or we need to make a ventriloquist's reservation where they can be looked after by zookeepers and until the numbers... Oh, God, imagine what it'd be like if two ventriloquists had sex.
Oh, dear.
Would the dummies have to be there with them? Would the dummies commentate? Would the dummies have to have intercourse at the same time?
I think the dummies are being cucked in that instance. I think because they're used to having such an intimate relationship with their partner, their stage partner, and so they both sat there and made to watch.
They're watching their master getting fisted and saying, now how do you like it?
Now how do you like it? Exactly, yeah. That's
The real difficult thing is, of course, is what if... Not every ventriloquist's dummy is a human being. So there may be perfectly consensual human sex, but the puppet sex may be bestial.
Well, this is it. If you're talking David Strassman, I mean, his main two puppets are Chuck Wood, who's like a little boy, so problems, and then and Teddy Bear, which is, you know, dangerous in the real world.
Yes.
But like... I liked your idea of stamping them out, Ben, because I'm curious as to like, because in order to do that, do you need, because it's sort of, yeah, it takes a killer to catch a killer. So in the same way, in order to stamp them out, we'd need a sort of dark Sith force of ventriloquists whose job it is to hunt them.
You need like Christopher Lloyd in the Roger Rabbit movie. He's a toon eliminating the toons. You need a ventriloquist dummy to eliminate the ventriloquist dummy.
A ventriloquist dummy who's like Judge Doom, who looks
Judge Doom,
so much, who's got false eyes in to make him look more like a human being. And actually, he's really tall, but actually his operator is just underneath him in a trench coat the whole time.
I have a better idea. What we need
How
to
dare
do
you? How
is...
dare you have a better idea?
I'm sorry, listen. There's no idea is a wrong idea in this tremendous anti-ventriloquism brainstorm. I suggest what we need to do is get the remaining ventriloquists on the British circuit.
Right.
Sorry, the phrase "the remaining ventriloquists" just really tickled me.
And convince them to play the burgeoning Saudi Arabian cabaret circuit and then frame them all for crimes they didn't commit. Chop, chop, their tools of the trade are gone.
Oh, my goodness. but that's so horrifying because they remain inside their bodies. That's oh, God.
But uncontrollable.
Oh, God, yeah. Or can you be a ventriloquist without hands?
Well, my dad used to have a party trick that was a bit like that.
Uh-oh.
we had Angus on about 100 episodes, 150 episodes ago now at this
God,
point.
That long ago.
We talked about the world's worst apology. And here you are again. Apologies for it being so late. But we will have asked you back then what you were worst at in the world. So let's flip it. What do you think? And I know Angus as a good friend of mine, Angus Duncan, you will find it hard to answer this. But what are you best at in the world?
Okay, well, funnily enough, what I'm best at in the world came up in the course of researching for this episode, and I'll tell you what it is. I think I am the best in the world at almost deciding to trash my entire life in favor of something I've just found out about. Because, like, I've got a really very strong Mr. Toad streak. And
big toad energy.
Massive toad energy. Like, I think this is the thing, is that I'm a 40-year-old man. My career's gone, whatever. There's been a pandemic. I've had two children. It's been hard to get on things. So I have, like, this sort of hair trigger, hyperfixative, maybe this is what I should have been doing the whole time. and last night, going through my notes for this and doing some more research about ventriloquism on the internet with a pine, my God, guys. the temptation to just cash it all in and buy, like, the seminal work on the subject of ventriloquism and trying to retrain. It was very close. But I had to stop and have a quick word with myself, which was wrong, because that meant that I was doing
it incorrectly. Yes. It would have been lovely if we'd have just got a telegram from you this morning going, "Can't do podcast, stop, have enrolled in the Premier Ventriloquism School."
It would be such a good sort of midlife breakdown to fuck off and do that. I mean, I think that would be a really, I mean, I almost want to do that so that people have an interesting answer to the question, "How's Angus? Have you seen him lately?"
Have you just, it's very much based on the stats you said earlier, where we've gone from 400, 500 vents to about 15 in the case of half a century. You've gone from deciding, "I don't want to be a little fish in a big pond. I want to be a big fish in a completely dried up and therefore deadly pond." To me, a fish.
I want to flip flop around in a drying puddle and force myself to grow lungs.
Yeah,
that's what I want to do. I want to brute force evolution on myself.
I love it. You're going to try and be Dr. Moreau.
Yeah, don't you want to be Dr. Moreau? The last guy to play Dr. Moreau didn't really want to be Dr. Moreau.
So. No, he did not, as we have talked about on this podcast. No, I don't want to be latter career Marlon Brando.
I don't know. Some of us would settle for latter career Marlon Brando at this stage.
I'll take any stage. I'll take like Brando with the flu when he was 12 at this point.
Yeah. Going to talk about, as you will all have heard so far, the world's worst ventriloquist. And Barry, you're going to start us off.
Indeed. I looked at the etymology of ventriloquist, which I did know. It comes from the Latin venter, meaning womb, and loqui, meaning speak. So speaking from the womb or the belly, you could also use venter for. But there's also an ancient Greek version of it as well. So it's ventriloquist through the Latin, but it's an engastromyth through the Greek, which I quite like.
What a word.
Gastro for stomach and mythos for speech.
Yes.
And you had various oracles, including those at Delphi, who could perform ventriloquism and make it sound like demons were speaking from their stomach and things like that, so they'd be able to speak without their mouths moving and proclaim various predictions. And
the thing I really liked, actually, because I read and it said that, you know, originally ventriloquism was a religious practice, you know, which is like the rabbi and the golem was just a popular act that they would do each year during Purim.
Rabbi and golem be on the same bill as cannon and ball and exactly, large. Yeah.
I'm so glad that you attributed that to Judaism, because I feel of all the Abrahamic religions, ours is the most music hall.
No shit, dude. Yeah. It's a billion percent.
Priests are preaching, imams are, I don't know, doing something. Imaming. I presume it's very solemn. Imaming, yeah. And rabbis are always about 30 seconds away from just doing a bit.
Yeah. And it's the shruggiest of the religions, isn't it? And that gives itself to comedic timing.
There's lots of, basically, the using dolls and things was, like, not until basically the 1700s-1800s that you really had people doing acts with dolls or even moving onto the stage. Like you said, it was religious figures or soothsayers and various fortune tellers. Yeah. I like this story, though. It did have a religious connotation with Cardinal Richelieu. In his reign as Louis XIII's chief minister, he had he decided to play a prank on the Bishop of Lavore, Charles-François Dabre de Racony, when they were having a walk in the Tuileries Gardens. basically he got a ventriloquist to throw his voice. So they were walking around and the bishop heard, "Abracadabrachidi, abracadabrachidi, I'm the spirit of thy father. For many years I've endured the pains of purgatory and expiation of my transgressions. God in his divine mercy has permitted me to come to warn thee against the irreprehensible course of life thou art leading, courting the favours and patronage of the great and neglecting thy religious duties." It's quite a long bit for a ventriloquist.
They really committed to the bit. I'm very impressed by this.
But apparently he was so shocked, and Richeland, the various other people around him, were sort of giggling to themselves, and they said, oh, they hadn't heard anything. And a later recounting of the story claimed that Racani actually was sort of in shock for several days afterwards before he was convinced it had just been a trick.
Whenever I see Cardinal Richelieu, all I can think of is a fox in scarlet robes from D'Artagnan.
That is terrifying.
That is canonically what he looks like, I think. I think we can all agree upon that.
The French loved having a tame ventriloquist, if you like. Louis Brabant was a valet to the French King Francis I in the 16th century. Charles I of England apparently had a ventriloquist as well. 1753, there was an event called Sir John Parnell in England who used to do... He basically did the hand without a puppet, so to speak, through his hand. And the first ventriloquist puppet, sort of recorded anyway, was 1757. An Austrian Baron de Mengen had a little doll in a show. And then the first one to go to America was a Scotsman called James Ranney, who came to Boston in 1801. And he had a dog called Tommy that was like a little child. But he would also do pranks around town. There was once a female fishmonger, who went up and asked her at her stall about how fresh her fish was. And she told him the batch had been caught the previous day. And then he made one of the fish say, "It is false, I'm a week older."
I mean, that's tremendous.
Yeah.
Love it. We've talked on the show before about various European courts having jesters as well, and they've got a magician, they've got a ventriloquist. Yeah. It's like basically European courts were the fringe. They were just like, would you like to go, should we go to the mixed bill of Henry VIII?
Yeah. Funny you mention Henry VIII, there is a story of a woman who was apparently a local soothsayer who sort of said, oh, Henry shouldn't marry Anne Boleyn. And Henry very much didn't like that. And I think she was imprisoned. And obviously he went on to marry Anne Boleyn and no problems ensued.
what I genuinely find really interesting, going back to what you were saying, Barry, like a minute ago about like, how these things have their sort of their inception as sort of religious or ritualistic practice. Mm. And then sort of as sort of culture evolves and the audience for religion sort of gets more sophisticated, these people who develop these skills sort of find themselves sort of like just out of the job and a bit sort of homeless. So they have to take up royal patronage. Probably somewhere there's still some sort of remote people who still like have like sort of juggling on a unicycle as a sort of sacred rite performed by the high ones.
Yeah.
like somewhere. Oh, that might still
exist. We need to go down to Covent Garden and declare all of the street performers the one
prophets.
Chosen Messiah.
Yeah, yeah, all the, yes. Yeah, they're all prophets. every single one of them. That's the really, like, because that's the thing. Is like, yeah, all of these things. You, I mean, we're aware of the relationship between ritual and smoke and mirrors. You know, it's all quite close, isn't it? It's all quite close in terms of what humans respond to.
He's not the Messiah. He's a very gaughty guy.
Very gaughty guy. Very nice, lovely. Very good.
I think we've mentioned on the podcast before. I'm sure. We have the Cadaver Synod. We recently talked about it in one of our reels on Instagram.
Always worth talking about again.
Yeah, in January 897, there was a trial held in the Basilica of St. John Lateran in Rome, and it was conducted by Pope Stephen VI, who was the next successor but one to Pope Formosus. And on trial was the late Pope Formosus. Who had been dead.
I thought you were about to describe
months.
Him as the late,
the late
great
Pope Formosus. Well, according to Pope Stephen VI, very much not great.
No.
It basically seems like the act of a madman wanting to... It's like if Joe Biden were dead and Trump was president. You could imagine Trump digging up Biden and putting his corpse on trial just so he could rant and rave at it for several days, which is very much what this was.
Fucking hell, man.
Yeah, they exhumed Pope Formosus' corpse. Had it brought to the papal court, and Stephen VI basically litigated the whole case, accusing Formosus of perjury and having been an illegal pope and presiding over more than one diocese and all of these things. And with the corpse was propped up on the throne, and to do the answers for the corpse, they did appoint a deacon who had to do the voice and respond to Stephen's accusations.
Oh, God. See, now what I like about that, they appointed a deacon to do the voice, which to me suggests that there were at some point auditions.
Yeah. Like, Vatican's Got Talent.
Yeah. Definitely.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a famous painting of it as well. It is really grim. At the end of the trial, they obviously found Formosus guilty and they chopped off his blessing fingers. And they chucked his corpse in the Tiber.
Not my blessing fingers.
Yeah, not my blessing fingers, yeah. I've got one really good vent I want to mention before I come to my worst vent. And this is a vent with a relation to ventricles. Because
I did wonder if there was a relationship between those words.
Well, wait till you hear why. This was an American ventriloquist called Paul Winchell. Remarkable sounding guy. He hosted a TV show and his own titular TV show. And later on, he hosted a kids' TV show called Winchell Mahoney Time because he had a ventriloquist dummy called Jerry Mahoney.
Yeah, yeah.
And Knucklehead Smith was another one of his. He also pioneered the idea of actors putting their hands through the sleeves of the dummies. So a bit like the Swedish Chef, for example. You've got the workable hands as well as the moving head and speaking head. And he appeared appears on all of the TV shows you can imagine. Perry Mason, Dick Van Dyke Show, Brady Bunch, the Beverly Hillbillies. And in animation, you will know Winchell's voice because he is the original voice of Tigger, Dick Dastardly, and Gargamel from the Smurfs.
Ah, that's him! Oh. Yes, 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 yes!
Same guy, yeah.
What a showreel.
Aside from all of that, he was the first person, along with a certain Dr. Henry Heimlich, the inventor of the Heimlich maneuver, to build and patent a mechanical artificial heart.
What is this man even doing? He's voicing Dick Dastardly,
yeah,
and he is also building a mechanical heart.
I love this. I love this so fucking much when you just discover kind of random polymaths. That's my favorite thing to find online. That's good.
Yeah. So, artificial hearts are typically used to bridge the gap between heart transplant surgery. So they're at the moment, the ones that exist are for less than a year.
It's like discovering that Mr. Tumble is working on genetically altered crops to help people in the sub-Saharan Africa.
I'd fucking believe it. Part of 24 karat gold, that man.
Well,
it's funny you should mention sub-Saharan Africa, because in the 80s, along with the likes of Richard Dreyfuss, Ed Asner, and Dr. Heimlich, Winchell appeared before a congressional committee pitching a scheme that he had developed to cultivate tilapia, a type of fish that thrives in brackish waters, which he wanted to introduce into sub-Saharan Africa to help combat hunger. The committee in the American Congress declined funding it. But yeah, as well as his artificial heart idea, he had developed a method for cultivating tilapia.
I sort of feel like that man's inspiration brain is just a big tombola of random concepts.
Yeah.
And he just picks out whatever he was like, this week I'm going to be using ledger domain to help neuroscientists in Sierra Leone.
That's gorgeous. That's so, so good. Can I quickly tell you my favorite one of those that I've got?
Please do.
She is a woman called Rosalind Drexler. Who, great name, still alive, and she's in her 90s and she lives in New York, and she's had this sort of mad career as a kind of conceptual artist, but she was also an ex-wrestler. She was like oddly, most people know her from writing under the pseudonym from writing the novelization, the very good novelization of the film Rocky. Like, she's got this like mad storied career as a real Greenwich Village art person, but then that's also amazing. This parallel career as like one of the great female wrestlers of her generation, early female wrestlers.
Incredible. Just want to mention the last couple of Winchell's inventions: a disposable razor, blood plasma defroster, a flameless cigarette lighter, a garter belt with no outwardly visible lines, a fountain pen with a retractable tip, and battery heated gloves.
Does this man work for Scrooge McDuck?
Yeah. The battery heated gloves, you just sort of feel, were like an offshoot of the ventriloquism.
I think you're close, Angus. I think he doesn't work for Scrooge McDuck. I think he is the supreme life president of the Acme Corporation.
Yeah, right? Yeah, man, this guy with this one very loyal client who lives in the desert. Yeah. who's been working on a personal project for many years.
Yeah.
Incredible. But I am going to go for my world's worst ventriloquist, and it may be sacrilege to vent fans everywhere, but I am going to choose Edgar Bergen. Now, where to start with Edgar Bergen? He was originally born Edgar Berggren, B-E-R-G-G-R-E-N, and he changed his name for ease of pronunciation, which is such a ventriloquist move. but he is, you know, the puppetry organization UNIMA describe him as the quintessential ventriloquist of the 20th century. He's probably the most famous ventriloquist of the 20th century before you get to the likes of Jeff Dunham and so on.
Feels like a poisoned chalice somehow, that title. A poisoned chalice that he drinks from whilst the ventriloquist dummy speaks.
Yeah. Yep. He's also the father of actress Candace Bergen. More about that shortly.
Yeah.
But he, I mean, he was a huge star from very early on in his career. In the 1930s, he was on a radio show called The Chase and Sanborn Hour with his puppet Charlie McCarthy, precocious child in a top hat and cape and monocle. And there was sort of a similar famous puppet in Britain at the same time, Archie Andrews. Peter Brough, the famous British ventriloquist, had Archie Andrews. In America, Charlie McCarthy was the most famous one. And he was on this radio show with W.C. Fields, Mae West. They were his co-stars on the show. And his whole shtick was, as I said, he was this precocious child. He would have this feud with W.C. Fields. He'd talk about trying to, like, find shade from the sun underneath W.C. Fields' enormous nose and flirt with Mae West. A typical exchange might go something like, "Mae, you weren't so nervous and backward when you came to see me at my apartment. In fact, you didn't need any encouragement to kiss me. Charlie, did I do that? Mae, well, you certainly did. I got the marks to prove it, and splinters too."
Oh, God.
Which is pretty risque for the 1930s.
Yes, another, yeah. Another especially exchange. If Mae West is saying it, and she's going, "I got the splinters to prove it."
yeah, exactly. Particularly with Mae West. Yeah, another exchange. Charlie says, "May I have a kiss goodbye?" Dale Evans says, "Well, I can't see any harm in that, Charlie. Oh, I wish you could. A harmless kiss doesn't sound very thrilling."
so that immediately makes me think, and I might have mentioned it before, and I'm gonna slightly mangle this, but I'm sure I remember Billy Connolly either telling a story or having a routine about if you were a ventriloquist, what you'd really want is if you were a female ventriloquist, is that while a man is performing cunnilingus, to throw your voice and go, "While you're down there," absolutely love as an idea.
The thing about being a radio, and I hope people have twigged at this point that I mentioned this is a ventriloquist dummy on the radio. The very concept is ludicrous. And what's even funnier is that Charlie the puppet would often twit Bergen for moving his lips. And when he later went on to appear on TV and in films, he's not a very accomplished ventriloquist at all. His lips move constantly. And I mean, if that is the one thing a ventriloquist kind of needs to be able to do.
Damn it, you had one job.
You had one job. And the puppet on the radio show is literally ribbing him for it the entire time.
Fucking hell.
Again, similar thing when Peter Brough and Archie Andrews moved to TV in the UK. Again, it showed that Peter Brough was moving his lips all the time. He even tried. He used a cigar to try and mask his mouth. The Chase and Sanborn Hour was the show that Bergen was on. There is some argument that perhaps the existence of that show and Edgar Bergen by extension saved the world.
Excuse me.
No, I know this one. Tell Ben.
On the night of October the 30th, 1938. The Chase and Sanborn Hour drew an enormous audience on American radio, therefore meaning that most of the American public didn't listen to Orson Welles' version of War of the Worlds radio play, which went out the same night. Some of the I think we've probably talked about the radio show before and how the myth of it causing panic across America is probably not anywhere near as true as anyone likes it to think, but one of the reasons for it is simply that there was a much more popular variety show happening on the radio at the same time, which people would have been listening to instead. But yeah, Edgar Bergen went on to appear into radio shows until the mid-50s. He was in various movies and TV shows. Candace, his daughter, appeared in season one of The Muppet Show, and so Edgar appeared in season two, and then his last ever screen performance was on in the Muppet movie in 1979. He died shortly after filming his appearance. He's in the Miss Bogan County bit. If you remember, they go, Fozzie and Kermit are traveling across America, and they go to a county fair, and Miss Piggy, of course, is going to win the Miss Bogan County pageant, and Elliot Gould is the announcer, and he thanks the judges, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, and it cuts to literally themselves wearing signs saying judges, and Charlie says, with Edgar's lips moving. You're not going to believe who the winner is, folks. And Edgar says, oh, come now, Charlie, it's their movie. And it's very much a sort of a passing of the baton.
Jim Henson,
a big fan of a previous puppeteer.
That's very sweet.
Yeah, the movie is dedicated to his memory because, as I say, he died shortly afterwards.
Nice.
But as I said, lips always moved. And if you read Candace Bergen's memoir, A Fine Romance, he left his daughter nothing in his will, but left $10,000 to Charlie McCarthy, the dummy.
The dummy. The dummy had its own room in the house, didn't it?
Yes.
The dummy had its own bed.
Called it his son. Candace Bergen said, I chased my father's approval all my life, and here was proof I'd never get it. I was hurt, shocked when I discovered he'd left me out of his will. Apparently in the will, he said, I make this provision for sentimental reasons, which to me are vital due to the association with Charlie McCarthy, who's been my constant companion and has taken on the character of a real person and from whom I have never been separated, even for a day.
I am heartbroken that he was successful, because if he had been struck for cash, then he would have been a fantastic bat villain.
Yeah.
well, more of that when we get to my section.
Hey, okay, cool.
Well, I will leave you with the last of Candace Bergen's words on the matter. She said, sometimes I have to give myself credit for being a functional human being.
don't we all, Candace?
Don't we all?
Don't we all?
I got very excited about this brief, because I feel like I've seen quite a lot of ventriloquists, it turns out. Like, I don't know, I think I secretly quite like it quite a lot. I started making a list of the acts that I'd seen, and then I put down Rod Hull, and I was like, wait a minute, no, that's not ventriloquism, that's just a man.
No,
that's just a man with a vicious, basically a split personality. I saw Keith Harris and Orville more than once, and also him. It's Cuddles the monkey, isn't it? It's Cuddles the monkey.
Oh,
well.
God, I forget about Cuddles.
Yeah, everyone forgets about Cuddles.
Of course, for our non-UK listeners, I recommend all of you go and YouTube and look up Rod Hull and Keith Harris and Orville.
I saw him when I was like a kid, and then I think my parents got like a poster for me after we'd seen him at like the Eastbourne Congress Theatre. And we got a poster for it. So I had this poster of Keith Harris on my wall, like huge poster for years. And it was this the most wonderfully like sort of like late 70s, like open shirt collar, gold chain, the like with like like an inch of Vaseline on the lens. It's really glowing Keith Harris.
I wonder if this is the moment at which to tell everybody that I had a Rolf Harris poster on my wall when I was younger.
This is the moment, indeed.
I did have a Rolf Harris. I saw him in concert when I was about 9. My dad had got him to sign a poster.
Fuck. There was a restaurant near where I used to live in Honor Oak Park, and they had an original. The owner had a Rolf Aru drawn for them by Rolf.
Oh no!
And I remember going for pizza there a couple of days after the allegations had surfaced, and the Rolf Aru was still up, and we were sort of like, and that was like the barometer. We're like, the Rolf Aru is still there. He's holding out.
He hasn't lost Honor Oak Park.
He hasn't lost Honor Oak Park yet. We went there a week later. Gone. Absolutely replaced with a nice vista of Southern Italy. But yes, I've seen like loads of guys. I've seen David Strassman. Have you ever seen David Strassman? Have you ever seen him? He's an American. He's fucking incredible, and he used to work for Henson. So as well as being a fantastic actual ventriloquist, he has animatronics that he brings on. He's got like a trio of singing dinosaurs.
That rings a bell. Yeah.
And he had a talk show for like a short while as well. Like they really doubled. He had a fantastic agent. They really doubled down on him. And I saw, obviously, and Ken Dodd used to do ventriloquism as well. He used to have the Diddy Men, and I saw that live, and so I was quite attached to all of this going in. And like yourself, Barry, you know, I did some searching around, sort of trying to sort of find other acts as well. But the one I kind of landed on was a guy called Sandy Powell, who I'd never heard of before, and he died the year before I was born. He died in 1982. He was born in 1900. And he was like known for his radio work in the 30s, and he had like the most sort of Paul Whitehouse catchphrase. His catchphrase was "Can you hear me, mother?" And that, which does sound made up. It sounds like if you asked an AI to come up with a music hall catchphrase.
Yeah.
He had this when I read about people like this, I always get sort of like quite wistful, because like this guy made 85 records between 1929 and 1942. 85, like 78 recordings of like him doing sketches, just in like, because people just used to buy 78s of people doing double acts, of people doing like, or one sketch, you know, people just used to have that on a 78. And this fucker made 85 of them.
85 of them. Yeah. You sort of get in your head, you imagine a lot of those acts in the period doing kind of the same sketch, like they have their entire act and it's just the same act.
No, this guy was crapping it out. It was, I mean, you know, and the thing is, you know, at the time sketches were, some of them were like public domain and things like that, some of them were probably somebody else's, or they were kind of maybe just sort of like music hall standards or whatever. But like, he sold 7.5 million records.
Holy shit.
Good lord.
Madonna could never.
I know, right? Earning a penny a side. That was £60,000, which is fucking nuts. But yeah, but I was particularly attracted to him because he for years he had a sort of company called the Starlight Company, which I think is wonderful. And they were this real kind of belt and braces, like small music hall company that had two backdrops. It was mega cheap, but they were all like super committed, like lifers, like this was all they did. And it was much beloved. And they performed at the end of Eastbourne Pier, which is where I'm from, for 15 seasons, and it earned him the nickname Mr. Eastbourne, which I was, made my feathers ruffle slightly, because I felt I like to think that I'm Mr. Eastbourne, but never mind. But the reason why he's the world's worst ventriloquist is that he chose to be. Like, he was a deliberately crap ventriloquist. That was like a cornerstone of his act, was that he'd go on stage wearing this sort of band leader's uniform, which didn't fit him very well. So he would be in this sort of proto Tommy Cooper shambolic mode, and he'd bring on this puppet which looked like it had been rescued from a fire. Like, like his part of its face was like off, like his thing, and it was clear from the beginning that he was like crap and actually doing the act.
I'm just gonna pause you there, because you've reminded me. There's Vent Haven, is this ventriloquist like museum in Kentucky in America, which, if anyone's seen the brilliant Nina Conti documentary Her Master's Voice, it features in that. But there's one of the puppets in there, which is, I can't remember the name of it. The premise of the puppet is that it's the only survivor of a ship going down. So the idea of this puppet being rescued from a fire is completely believable to me as a backstory for your puppet.
Well, what was great about, like, what I love about this, I've watched like several iterations of this act. I've watched him doing it on the Royal Variety Performance, and what's great is that, like, a minute and a half into the act, Sandy Powell's wife comes out on stage and just starts saying, "This isn't very good. You should stop." So what's great is that the act of him being a bad ventriloquist like seegs into like an intervention to stop him, to please stop, and him trying
if
to
only ins- more acts had
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, imagine that. That'd be so great. Joe Pasquale's on, and then friends and well-wishers slowly gather.
Joe, we've come to talk to you about your destructive relationship with prop comedy.
Yeah, here's a banner that we've made, because we've told you, respond to physical objects, please.
Yeah.
It just says, "We love you, please stop." Genuinely, it's a great act, but like, I had to. It is technically, he's technically the world's worst ventriloquist because he chose to be.
It sounds very like post comedy in a way.
Yeah, it was. I was mega impressed in kind of that way that, like, you know we arrive at these sort of more heightened, sophisticated, mischievous forms of things, but actually, like, the music hall guys kind of got there organically. They just didn't have a name for it. They just found something that worked by virtue of just constant mutation.
Yeah,
and it's really lovely. So Sandy Powell is definitely my pick for that. He did die in Eastbourne, and he had a house on Elms Avenue, and I recognised that address. I was like, wait a minute, and I googled it, and it's my mate's old flat.
Oh wow.
Was your mate a sort of bedraggled looking ventriloquist?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Looked like it'd be rescued from fire.
His master had died.
Yes. So
he's just been there ever since as the dark custodian of Elms Avenue.
Of all my friends, Angus, you are the person most likely to befriend a ventriloquist.
I've been in a lot of codependent relationships with my life with damaged individuals, and that would just be the latest, frankly. But like, it was
yeah,
just,
but not
it,
many of them have suffered from water damage.
Yeah, his girlfriend gave him termites. just as one other guy I just wanted to bring up. You can cut this out if you like, but I just thought it was interesting because a guy called Fred Russell, who was like the along with your man that Barry was talking about, is considered one of the big fathers of ventriloquism. He like wrote the book on it, which is like called Ventriloquism and the Kindred Arts, which sounds much more mystical than it needs to do. but he was also a founding member of a, and you guys might know about this, a entertainment fraternity called the Grand Order of the Water Rats, Have yes. you guys, you know about them, right? You know about them. Okay. I didn't know about them. Just to go back to what we were saying a minute ago about what I'm best at in the world. Found out about the Grand Order of the Water Rats, and second only to my ability at like wanting to change my life for anything is my desire to be included. It's my desire to be included in things. It's just like this sort of this residual bit of sort of like private school shrapnel that wants me to be in private members clubs.
I mean, it feels like a problem of stand-up comedians that we absolutely don't want a boss. And we don't really play well with others, but we also do want to be included in gangs.
Massively want to be included in gangs.
That way mental ill health lies.
But the thing that managed to cure me of this is that I went on the website for the Grand Order of the Water Rats, which is the most GeoCities piece of shit you've seen in a while. I went on that, and a swift look down like the membership list of that immediately cured me of my desire to be included in it, because it was a group of like ruddier faced white guys. You have never seen. Like, it looks like a group of guys who have taken like a season doing like stand up impressions and a couple of songs at the end of Yarmouth Pier for one summer until, inverted commas, the heat is off. Like, that's the vibe of the Water Rats.
When I engaged the services of Angus for this podcast, I did remind him that a lot of our shorthand for this podcast is inevitably ends up in the worlds of Nazism, evangelical Christianity, niche Japanese culture, and dog murder.
Yeah.
And I have not found a evangelical Nazi who ventriloquized a dead dog in Japan, sadly.
One day that'll be our Google whack, though.
Yeah.
One day it will.
So now you're going to commit seppuku because you failed? Is that what?
Yeah. I'm heading to the Lemmy Museum of Nazi Memorabilia to use Hitler's favourite letter opening knife to commit seppuku. I did type in Nazi ventriloquist and I did find something.
Oh, no.
It wasn't a Nazi ventriloquist. It was actually a British gentleman, a British soldier who was kept prisoner. We go to Stalag 2B, which was a German prisoner of war camp. And
it was specifically for pencils.
Yeah.
So sorry.
Very nice. I liked it. I like that joke. It wasn't too hard. It wasn't too soft.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It had a point.
Yeah.
Obviously, the commandant in charge of them was called the Eraser.
Very nice.
No, I'm sad.
Nice. Yeah,
it was silly, and now I'm sad.
Yeah. Like, obviously, like so many of these horrific places, the soldiers and the inmates in there, like, did what they could to try and keep their spirits up. Enter one Private Billy Booth, who had worked as a children's entertainer and puppeteer before the war started. And he made himself a puppet. And he made this puppet out of soaked potato starch and painted him with a smuggled pot of pink gloss that a Polish farmer had given him, which had been used to paint his daughter's cot. And
So sorry. I'm imagining the Polish farmer making the handover and Billy Booth going, "What the fuck are you giving me pink gloss for? I wanted a hacksaw and a map."
Fake some passports.
The Polish farmer's like, "But the paint is pink. It's very expensive."
Oh, that's very nice. Yeah, I really like the point-and-click adventure game sort of like object exchange.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
What's going on here.
Also, I've made the mistake of saying that Billy Booth was British, because it's an extraordinarily British name, but I think he was actually American.
Right.
Cool.
And he made the dummy. The dummy was called Mr. Fritz. And apparently Billy was incredibly talented. He entertained both the prisoners and even some of the guards with his jokes and songs. And he did this for 18 months.
Fuck.
Unfortunately, this story ends sadly. 2 weeks before the camp was liberated, Billy and 9 other American POWs were taken to a field, dug a pit, and shot for not working hard enough. A brutal heckle, I'm sure we can agree. Mm. Now,
what about Mr. Fritz?
Yeah, that was an immediate follow-up question, yes.
When the camp was finally liberated on the 28th of January 1945, Mr. Ritz was taken back to America by a fellow prisoner and given to Billy Booth's family as a reminder of their son's bravery in these awful conditions. And then over the years, he ended up in various different places. He ended up in was discovered again in an antiques mall in Myrtle Beach. A dealer in World War II memorabilia found out about his connection to a German POW camp, brought him back to the UK, and then sold him on to a chap called Michael Diamond. And Michael, his speciality is in oddities. So he's got things like a waxwork of an elephant-headed boy and real execution swords and axes. And right. The reason why Mr. Fritz ended up in his inverted commas freak room is because Mr. Fritz is a haunted ventriloquist's doll.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because... Because Mr. Fritz's eyebrows will go unbidden, his mouth will go unbidden. If he is left alone in a room, the glass display case that he is in will pop open. Sometimes the display case is frowned 6 to 12 inches further on the table than when it was left. And right. This has freaked out Michael Diamond. And he's like, Mr. Fritz is in his own part of the freak room, so well good. Away from everyone else, but he keeps wanting to join in. There is even footage of Mr. Fritz on a camera with the eyebrows doing his thing and the mouth doing his thing. And listen, it could be humidity, it could be changes in air temperature,
it could be that toxic pink paint,
yeah,
it could be, or it could be the ghost of Billy Booth living on through his doll.
I love that, because the nice thing about that is that to me suggests that Billy Booth knew that he was to be executed, and the doll this whole time wasn't a means of entertainment. He was just building a horcrux. He was just building.
Oh my god, yes.
he was just building a place to save his game.
Oh, it's very much like Harry being the horcrux and him, you know, the doll of a German being a horcrux. It sort of fits that the enemy is obviously the thing that will save him ultimately.
I love that. I love that so much. Thing is about ventriloquist dolls is that, like, if you are an aspiring horror writer, it seems like an obvious thing, but there you could just do far worse than spend an evening just googling ventriloquism, because it's just so horrifying.
It is part of the reason why it's declined in popularity. Is I think funny enough, literally television is one of the reasons, because it's very, like, if you're on stage, you're far enough away from audiences by and large that they can't see the mouth move quite as well. But also just the proliferation of creepy doll stories and movies and things has really helped do for it as a
yeah, it really has. They are it's a funny part of the uncanny valley. It's obvious, like, ventriloquist dolls are in you go down a B road just off the uncanny valley and then to a dirt track, and then you go to a little abandoned shack in its own separate uncanny valley, and that's the one full of ventriloquist dolls, because it doesn't matter whether they are brand new or they were like Mr. Fritz, they're made out of, you know, old German newspapers and genocide and they are just terrifying. Yeah. Here's a nice little segue to an amazing headline that Google threw my way. Neo-Nazi ventriloquist who went on racist Starbucks rampage says he's not racist.
So here we are, then. This is where you eat.
Is this a Florida man story?
You took the words right out of my mouth. But no, I'm afraid to say it's an Illinois man.
How Illinoisan.
Andrew R. Angel, a 44, allegedly attacked a Hispanic man who was resting in his car in the city of Countryside, southwest of Chicago. Angel allegedly put a flyer with a swastika on the man's car, and when the man saw it, he followed Angel into the Starbucks and attempted to hand it back to him. Angel then allegedly caused a disturbance inside the Starbucks and then left waiting for the Hispanic man outside. Angel allegedly cursed and yelled more racial slurs at the man and dared him to act by saying, "What you're going to do about it?" Angel's car was searched by the police. He found clothing with swastikas, Confederate flags, a KKK hood, white supremacist literature, and a ventriloquist's dummy. Angel's defense was that he wasn't targeting the Hispanic man, and that the racial slurs were uttered because he was singing along with a rap song. He says, "I put the flyers on anybody's vehicle, no matter what their race. The American Nazi Party accepts support from any race. I wasn't singling him out. It's not about white supremacy, but more of a political group that shows interest in helping people with taxes and jobs."
At which the dummy said, "No, it isn't. It's a racist movement, and we want to kill them all."
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, you're going to get us in trouble. The dummy saying the thing that the guy couldn't bring himself to say.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, the dummy was actually trying to say "yay, yay, yay," but he wasn't a very good ventriloquist, so he said "KKK" instead.
Yeah, if Trump was smart, he could have tried to blame the whole thing on Mike Pence, couldn't he? Whose lips never moved.
Yeah.
Just a quick one that I discovered. You talked about Batman villains earlier on. There is a Batman villain called the Ventriloquist.
No.
There's a number of different incarnations of him, but I went to the original one. I'm not going to talk about him much. He is sort of like similar to Joaquin Phoenix's Joker, where he performed on stage, was booed off, and that turned him into a twisted villain. And he sort of like dresses a bit like a gangster, and he executes his crime through a dummy named Scarface. But my favourite thing about the ventriloquist is that his name in the comics is Arnold Wesker. But Barry is immediately frowning because he might know that Arnold Wesker is one of the most decorated British Jewish playwrights of the 20th century.
Yes.
And I don't really know how this has happened.
Same guy.
Same guy, yeah, same guy.
I got confused for a second there because I thought he was the baddie from the original Resident Evil, but actually, that's Albert Wesker.
Presumably Arnold Wesker gets his puppet to speak while he's drinking chicken soup with barley.
Literary joke there. I liked it. It's very good. Yes.
Very, very good. Very good. Very good. The water rats are calling for you, Barry.
Yeah. I'm off to do a pier at the season at the end of the pier in Yarmouth until this all blows over.
Yeah. When a critic turns up for one of the water rats, are they doing a peer review? Anyway.
Oh, very nice. See, there's something about, I mean, it's a shame because I love the end of the pier vibe. I really do, because I have got a genuine fondness for it. Because like, one of my happiest memories is going with my parents to the end of Yarmouth Pier to see Rod Hull and Emu and the Grumbleweeds, if you guys know who they are.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was a tour de force. It was one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life. But that's the thing about a pier, it's just, it feels like it's the stuff at the end of the pier feels like it's something that the world is literally holding at arm's length.
Yeah, yeah.
Away from society. It's like happening really on a space station.
Yeah, they've got real apocalyptic vibes. Apocalyptic vibes.
Yeah,
before we go to my nomination, we are going to go to Zaragoza in 1934 and a strange case of a duende, which roughly translates as an elf or a goblin. But this was no normal elf or goblin. This was a kitchen stove goblin. So, in September 1934, the Palazon family started hearing voices, screams, and laughter coming from their stove and chimney. And they lived in an apartment building, so they invited the neighbours in to come and listen, and they heard the voices as well. And word got around, and they suggested that maybe that the chimney could have been funneling voices from another room in the building. And so it became sort of an obsession. Sometimes the voices sort of would get specific, and they started becoming particularly focused on the family's maid, Pasquale Alcocer, and they would sometimes call out Pasquale's name and cackle. And this went on for so long that the Palazons got really scared and called in the police, because obviously the Ghostbusters weren't around in Zaragoza in the 1930s.
In a way that they definitely are today.
Yes. Oh, mate. One of our number has been called to service.
Good point, yeah. Good point, well made.
And so the police evacuated the building. They called in an architect and workman to search every single room from the cellar upwards, to search for a prankster or people hiding in the walls. Still nothing. And the voice continued to answer every question the police asked it. When one worker commented that the chimney opening should be measured, the voice reportedly answered back, "No need to worry, the diameter is just 6 inches." And that turned out to be accurate. The voice continued to go on until one day it suddenly stopped. stopped, and the police withdrew their investigation, only for the voice to reappear 2 days later, proclaiming, "Cowards, cowards, cowards, here I am." And the Platons had enough, left the town for good, and meanwhile, the police reopened the case, and public interest continued to soar. It was reported in the London Times on a daily basis. A Barcelona radio station tried to get a microphone into the room to broadcast the voice live. And finally, at the end of the year, more than 2 months after the voice was first heard, the governor of Zaragoza issued a statement that he hoped would put an end to the hysteria. He alleged that Pascuala, the family's maid, had been performing unconscious ventriloquism. In other words, she was throwing a voice and unaware of it.
Okay.
And the official who had presided over the investigation claimed to have seen this firsthand. And pretty much everyone who had gained hysteria around the story went, "Oh yeah, well that seems perfectly serviceable. We'll move on." And the hysteria all sort of died down, even though Pascuala hadn't been present for most of the occurrences, and this goblin voice identified as male. Now, listen, it's 2024. The voice that you throw can identify as whatever the hell you want. But even though normal life resumed in the apartment building, tenants reported that they still heard voices. However, any additional evidence disappeared after 1977 because the apartment complex was torn down, and the only remnants of it are the words "Edificio Duende" that are engraved in gold lettering beside the entrance of this thing that is literally known as the Goblin Building.
Oh.
Now, that's the movie I'd rather have seen than the Amityville Horror.
Yeah, that's the most Quatermass shit I've heard for ages. That's amazing. Yeah. I love that so much.
It's just the pipes.
Like, what's so nice about that is that we really are, like, missing a trick. We just by limiting ventriloquism to weird, shiny-faced boys doing, like, back-and-forth one-liners. Like, why are we not doing gorilla ventriloquism where it's just the building that you're next to?
Yes.
Or it's cars in the street? Why is there no... Like, we need to take the art form back to the streets, guys.
Oh, a ventriloquist act where the entire theatre is speaking to the audience.
Right?
Would be...
Oh, there we go. There we go.
Street ventriloquism, like a David Blaine guy going over and making a lamppost talk to a homeless guy.
Yeah, doing weird, sort of like that. Yeah, that's it. In a way, that's what you want, because it has this sort of mystical, shamanistic kind of like religious huckster kind of like genesis. So take it back to that, where you're just this wandering kind of like strange nutter conjuring voices from the post box and scaring guys. They're like, oh no, shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you just want just every time you put a letter in the postcard, so the postcard goes, "Thank you, sir. Delicious." But that's not my nomination. For my nomination, we're going to San Francisco in the early 90s, and we're going to meet Robert Geary. Mm. And Robert Geary was an officer in the San Francisco Police Department. Now, before he became a police officer, he held an undergraduate degree in art, a master's degree in education. He was a member of the Screen Actors Guild, having worked as a hand model. And in 1991, he was assigned to a community policing position in North Beach. The program encouraged officers to be highly visible and use creative and ingenious methods to earn the trust of local civilians. And he decided the way to do this was to order an expensive wooden dummy out of a ventriloquist's catalogue and bring it with him on the beat.
No, it's not.
It is. You're going to hate this next bit, Barry.
I love this.
Because he chose the name for his dummy of Brendan O'Smarty.
No.
And according to the newspaper article I read, he did this to add dignity to the doll. The doll had a badge and a water pistol. There is an account that he carried the dory with him, and he was even able to function as an officer, even chasing and tackling at least one suspect with the dummy in hand, which has to be a real low ebb for that criminal.
I'm so sorry, but like, how does this man get employed?
Well, because listen, he was showing initiative.
No, he wasn't. He was showing his idiocy.
No, he responded to brief, Barry. Don't give the man his fucking credit.
Now, This is where this gets even more bizarre. Now, the man who had sort of allowed this initiative to thrive was a man called Richard Hongisto, and he was fired for ordering officers to destroy copies of the San Francisco Bay Times that had lampooned him over what the paper considered heavy-handed police response to the outbreak of rioting following the Rodney King police brutality verdict. Don't worry, that's the darkest turn this is going to take. Now, Hongisto had tolerated Brendan O'Smarty, probably because he had bigger fish to fry.
Yeah.
But his replacement, a chap called Tony Ribera, did not. And he ordered Geary to keep the dummy in the police car when he was out on patrol. Geary refused to do this, and so Geary in 1993 formed the Committee to Save Puppet Officer Brendan O'Smarty. This collected 10,000 signatures in a self-financed campaign and brought the matter to a local referendum, and it was went on the ballot during a general election in 1993.
I'm
and the
so
ballot's
sorry.
Wording
the ballot's driving me insane.
Yes, the ballot's wording was, shall it be the policy of the people of San Francisco to allow police officer Bob Geary to decide when he may use his puppet, Brendan O'Smarty, while on duty? And
the people versus
the San Francisco Police Department, and Geary won by the cursed margin of 51% to 49%.
Good lad.
And he continued to use the puppet throughout the 1990s and became somewhat of a local phenomenon.
When we waited another 20 years and it took a Supreme Court decision to legalize homosexual marriage in America. And listen, yet, the electorate in 1993 saw fit to...
Yes, and what you don't know is that that puppet was gay.
San Francisco with a man's hand up his jacksie. Of course
he was. Of course
he was,
yes. It's the city, man.
Geary and O'Smarty retired in the year 2000, and the mayor, whose name was Willie Brown, declared the day that they retired Officer Geary Day, and on his last day, he went on patrol with Brendan O'Smarty on a Wells Fargo stagecoach drawn by four horses.
Which were puppets.
Which were puppets as well.
They were puppets for War Horse.
Puppets yes. for War Horse.
So, I give you, gentlemen, yes. Officer Brendan O'Smarty and his operator, Robert J. Geary.
Absolute magic. And also, like, Ben, you've got small children. You learn to do things with only one hand.
Yes.
I reckon I could tackle a not particularly astute criminal to the ground if I still had my son on me.
Like, yeah, I mean,
did the puppet have itself a tiny little Mr. Punch style bat on to go with the pat on?
Surely
that his master has.
Surely,
yeah.
Absolutely, surely.
You'd hope so. So our nominee for the World's Worst Ventriloquists are Barry's nomination of the absolute Don, the godfather of 20th century ventriloquism, the man who saved us from a War of the Worlds apocalypse, Edgar Bergen. Angus's nominee of the Neil Hamburger of the ventriloquist world, Sandy Powell, a man who was gonged off by his own family. And my nominee of a serving police officer who took a ventriloquist's doll out with him and then took it to the people, and the people narrowly said yes, Robert J. Geary. Listen, I hate to toot my own horn on this one, but this feels like an open and shut case
for
Officer
Geary. No, this is a landslide,
Ben.
This is an absolute landslide. Yeah. No questions asked.
The people have spoken.
When you've when you've got a dummy that is an open carry dummy, he's openly carrying dummy, which is also, and the gun, the dummy's packing heat as well.
They had an election on whether this man could carry a doll around, and yet guns are just widespread, and they refuse to put the question of open carry on the ballot across the states.
It's because this is funnier.
It's astonishing. It's astonishing. And yet still in San Francisco, there was a criminal at large who kept an unlicensed alligator. There was health and safety issues about the sausages that he served, and regularly committed domestic abuse.
Violence, yes.
And yet did Officer O'Smarty do anything to stop this? No, he did not.
Mr. and Mrs. Punch of Tent Avenue.
Yes.
ACAP. All cops are puppets.
Amazing.
Of the state,
Angus,
yeah?
before Before we go, where can our listeners find you? What can they find you doing when they get there?
I'm still emerging from my dad hole in terms of sort of regular work. But if you want to see all the kind of things that I'm up to, you can go to angusdunican.com, where there are links to all of my various projects, bits and or pieces. You can find links there to the various bits of Doctor Who that I've written, to the podcast that I've been on and will soon be on as well, and any other announcements. I'm incredibly easy to find on most social media platforms as just Angus, at Angus Dunican, because I'm the only one. That's the wonderful thing about Tiggers.
You are indeed. And I realise I have done this back to front and upside down, and that's absolutely fine, but I am going to end with our best news of the week before we say our goodbyes. And this is news a lot of you have probably heard about, because it's been all over the news cycle. But frankly, ought to be said loudly, I'm giving a big up to Russ Cook, a.k.a. the Hardest Geezer,
yeah.
A man who has run the continent of Africa.
As in, he has run from one end to the other.
Sorry, yes. As
they haven't really centralised government of an entire continent.
Not, created a sort of syndicate.
Yes, I don't mean that in the 19th century colonial sense. I mean that he started
so weird.
Himself...
I thought Paul Kagame was a real dictator. Turns out he just was happy to hand over the keys to Russ. Yeah.
He's very charming.
Yeah,
he really is. Russ Cook, he's 27. He's run over 10,000 miles from the tip of South Africa all the way up to Tunisia. He's gone through 16 countries. He's run through deserts. He has run the equivalent of 385 marathons in 352 days. You can read much more about his story on all sorts of different news sources. Not only am I saying this is incredible, not only do I think he should win Sports Personality of the Year for his achievement, but also I'm sort of disgusted that he has only raised £850,000 for his chosen charities. And when I say only, I'm not having a go at him, I'm having a go at us, the public, because what he has done is surely one of the greatest solo athletic achievements of all time.
Yeah.
And yet some pampered celebrity prick on SportsAid manages to do more on a very impressive endurance event, but not as impressive as running across one of the seven continents on the planet.
And so he did it the desert bit last.
Yes.
Like, he did it when he was getting tired. He then had to cross the
Sahara.
Desert
bit, yeah. This for me in a way is the greatest achievement, and I think you'll empathise with me on this one, Barry. Because the thing is, the chap in question is, you know, is sort of vaguely Nordic, sort of strawberry blondish, befreckled sort of. And arguably, I think the greatest achievement is the fact that over the course of it, because he did this for nearly a year, the fact that he didn't burst into flames throughout, I think is to be given special consideration as well.
Yes, good lord, one of the Fantastic Four has managed to run the entirety of Africa. So I'm going to put his donation link in the show notes and chuck him some money. I mean, all sorts of charities deserve money, but the sheer effort of what he has done deserves this contribution. Anyway, listen, enough of that. We're all off to pitch to the health ministry that all doctors should now have their own ventriloquist puppets to try and end waiting lists on the NHS. Until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.